about the response of living things when the climate shifts. When I interview plankton experts, they still don't know whether plankton will flourish or crash as the oceans warm. This response by the sargasso weed came as a complete surprise to the oceanographers. As the world warms, living things from the microscopic, which is the largest mass on this planet, to the large mammals, they will all change. Many species will disappear while invasive species take over. The carbon budget on land and sea will change, and that is the X factor when we try to estimate the speed and amount of climate change that is coming, or even when we try to plan our own lives. Nature will respond to our pollution and attacks with chaos and then new arrangements. Watch for signals from living things.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
For decades, Richard Heinberg led the charge to get off fossil fuels. Now, he says, the renewable energy transition is failing. Is he giving up? Should we give up? Heinberg is author of 14 books like The End of Growth and Power Down. His most recent book is Power, Limits and Prospects for Human Survival. You may have seen Richard in documentaries like The End of Suburbia or Planet of the Humans and DiCaprio's 11th Hour. He was among the first bloggers in the energy and climate arenas with his Muse letter, now around issue 359. Richard is senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. From California, Richard Heinberg, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, hi, Alex. It's great to be talking with you again.
A strange reality is unfolding around you in California. I lived in L.A. way back, never heard of an atmospheric river. California was the sunny place you want to be, and it's not so much this year. The Silicon Valley, well, crashed its own bank, and there's hundreds of thousands of homeless. Why is it so weird in California these days?
Well, you know, actually living here, it doesn't seem nearly as weird as it gets portrayed in the news. Here in Santa Rosa, we've had a lot of rain this year, which is great because we've had drought in recent years. But our average annual rainfall in Santa Rosa is 34 inches. We've had 37 inches of rain so far, so we're just a little above the seasonal average, and that's great. That's where we need to be. So, yeah, there are some trees down, and some people have been seriously inconvenienced by all this rain, but, you know, it could be a lot worse.
All right, maybe a case of bad press. And in your latest newsletter published in February, it was called Converging Debt Crisis. Are the recent bank failures part of that?
Well, sadly, I think so. The larger crisis that we're looking at is that we have created enormous amounts of debt, government debt, corporate debt, household debt, on the basis of the assumption that the economy is always going to grow, or just about every year the economy is going to grow. But, you know, economic growth is something that can't go on forever. It has real-world implications. When the economy grows, we use more energy and materials. And reality is we live on a finite planet. Economic growth comes at the expense of other species and future generations in the final analysis. Yeah, we can tinker around the edges with improvements in efficiency and so on. But realistically, the economy is already too big. And at some point, it's going to be downsized by processes over which we have very little control, like resource depletion and biodiversity loss. So what happens when that kicks in? Well, a lot of the debt that we've racked up, based on the assumption of continued economic growth in the future, is going to come due, and it's not going to be pretty from a financial perspective. So is Silicon Valley Bank just an early warning of that? Well, you know, it's kind of like tying today's weather to climate change. Well, it's impossible to say how much it's related, but, you know, I like to keep the big picture perspective in mind.
So why do you say the renewable energy transition is failing?
Just from the standpoint of carbon emissions, what we're seeing currently is we're building lots more solar panels, wind turbines. Billions of dollars are being directed into increasing the manufacture of renewable energy infrastructure. And yet, carbon emissions are still increasing. We reached record-level carbon emissions in 2022, even with all the effort that's being put into building renewables. So why is that? Well, once again, it goes back to economic growth. We're demanding that the economy continue to grow, which means we demand more energy. And the energy growth annually is greater than the new energy inputs from renewables. Now, yeah, we could just, you know, redouble our efforts, but how much would we actually have to do that? The best estimates that I've seen suggest that we would need to increase our funding for renewable energy by 5 times to 10 times what it is now. And that just doesn't seem to be on the horizon. So if we want to reduce carbon emissions, we're going to have to do something other than just building solar panels and wind turbines. We're going to actually have to start using less energy. And that means using less energy for things like transportation and manufacturing, because it's going to take a lot of energy to build all the solar panels and wind turbines, and not just the panels and turbines, but all the other renewable energy infrastructure or electrical infrastructure that will be needed. This is a huge subject, actually, and it's one that very few people really appreciate in its depth, because we're not just talking about, you know, switching out energy sources. We're also talking about switching out enormous amounts of energy-using infrastructure, because most of our energy-using infrastructure today was built around the energy sources that we had in the past, which were solid, liquid, and gaseous fuels, as opposed to electricity, which is what solar and wind produce. And we only use 20% of our energy in the form of electricity. The other 80% we use in the form of fuels. So the energy transition is not just about building panels and turbines. It's about basically shifting our whole industrial model away from its reliance on fossil fuels toward entirely different energy sources. That's a huge project, and realistically, it's going to take decades. But I don't see that we've even seriously started. And the sign that we have seriously started will be that we actually begin reducing carbon emissions.
You spent decades investigating the limits of energy on this planet with articles and books about coal and oil and gas depletion. In your newer work, I'm hearing as much concern about the limits of minerals. Why is that?
Well, here's another facet of the renewable energy transition. It's going to take a tremendous amount of a wide range of minerals in order to build all of this new infrastructure. Most people are generally aware that we're going to need a lot of lithium for batteries and so on. But, you know, something as simple as sand, I think we kind of tend to assume that there's a heck of a lot of sand in the world. We could never run out of that. But actually, we need very specific forms of sand for producing silicon or even for producing concrete. You know, concrete is really the foundation of industrial civilization. And we use concrete also for anchoring wind turbines. So we'll need a lot of concrete in order to build all of this new infrastructure. Do we have enough sand? Well, it turns out we need very specific kinds of sand. The granules of sand have to be angular. They can't be all eroded and round. That just doesn't make very good concrete. It needs to be very pure if we're going to make silicon. Those special kinds of sand are actually getting very scarce. So that's just one mineral resource that we're going to need a heck of a lot of in the coming decades. And we have to understand also, if we insist on more economic growth, that also means vastly greater quantities of minerals. Over the last few decades, we've been doubling the size of the human economy every 25 years. That's the real-world implication of 2 to 3% economic growth annually. So doubling the size of the economy every 25 years also means that the amount of waste we're producing has doubled every 25 years. So can we continue that doubling rate out into the next few decades as we're also building all of this new infrastructure for the renewable energy transition? It's just an enormous project. Realistically, I don't think much of it's going to happen. I believe we really do need to build solar panels and wind turbines to produce electricity so that we have functioning electricity grids, maybe slimmed down grids in the future. But if we let the grids go, if the transition fails completely, then the result will be that we'll lose civilization itself because everything's been digitized. All our scientific knowledge, all of our financial records, everything has been digitized. So if the grid goes down once and for all, we're pretty much done for. So we've got to keep the grids up and running, and that means we'll need renewable electricity. But are we going to be able to also have enough renewable electricity for, you know, electric aircraft and all the other amenities that some of us might like to have? Realistically, I don't think so.
In your recent article at resilience.org, you introduce us to Simon Michaud at the Finnish Geological Survey. Simon wrote a report with quite a long title, but it's worth it, Assessment of the Extra Capacity Required of Alternative Energy Electrical Power Systems to Completely Replace Fossil Fuels. What did Michaud discover about our big plans for an energy transition?
Well, Michaud is an expert on mineral resources. He's with the Finnish Geological Survey. And he crunched the numbers and came to the conclusion that we simply don't have enough mineral resources to accomplish the renewable energy transition. Now, that conclusion has been criticized by some other researchers. So I guess you could say, in one sense, that we still don't know. But I have to say, even if Michaud is off by a factor of two, let's say we have twice as many mineral resources as he thinks we do, how much longer does that give us? Well, if we keep doubling the size of the global economy every 25 years, that gives us another 25 years. There are some French researchers who assumed a perfect rates of recycling, you know, recycling minerals and metals as well as we possibly can. And there are some practical limits on recycling because as we recycle many materials, they degrade over time. So it's impossible to have 100% recycling, but they assumed recycling at the highest levels currently technically feasible. And in their view, there are enough minerals for us to operate a renewable energy economy of the current scale of the global economy for about 200 to 300 years before we just finally run out of everything. So, you know, that's kind of the best possible case, because currently we aren't recycling anything at close to the maximum rates, and it will take us not just a technical revolution, but I think a social and economic revolution to get to the point where we're actually operating our economy on the basis of renewable energy and recycling everything at optimum rates. We're so far from that situation now that we're really talking about hypotheticals.
And this renewable energy revolution depends on a system of global cooperation and trade. I mean, lithium comes from one place and the chips come from somewhere else. Instead, we're seeing a split into major blocks. There's one war in progress, another possible. There are trade sanctions on some materials that you need for wind and solar. Richard, should we see the geopolitical divide as an important stumbling block for really getting renewable products and power?
Well, I'm sad to say, yes, it very likely is. Michael Clare is a scholar who's been working on this subject for a long time. He has books like The Race for What's Left and Resource Wars, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet. And in these books that he's written, he argues, I think very persuasively, that as our need for minerals and metals increases, and as geopolitical tensions mount over access to those resources, we're going to see the current kinds of geopolitical fault lines really run much deeper, and we could see a new round of wars on a scale that we haven't seen since the world wars of the 20th century. You know, the last few decades have seen a lot of regional conflicts, smaller scale conflicts, but generally speaking, we've had a period of relative world peace that has enabled lots of economic growth and a lot of general optimism about what we can do as human beings on this planet. But if we're going to continue with that kind of Pax Americana, is what some people have called it, because it's the U.S. as the global superpower that has sort of maintained this global level of peace. If we're going to continue that, it's going to require new mechanisms for conflict resolution that we currently don't have. And that's going to require compromise on all sides. It's going to require a general recognition that if we descend into resource conflict, then all of the problems that we're facing are going to get much, much worse. We'll have no chance at really solving climate change while maintaining industrial levels of production. It's really the worst of all possible worlds.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is author and post-carbon expert Richard Heinberg. We're talking about the real future. Well, we also have, in the United States in particular, popular resistance and sometimes armed resistance to any reduction in lifestyles. You'll get this gas stove from my cold dead hands, they say. Fossil fuel use is considered almost part of the Constitution or a God-given right. Apparently, millions of people would rather fight than give up anything. Is there any way to depoliticize this project to save civilization and our environmental home?
Well, we're going to have to depoliticize a lot of things, and I think that's going to have to start at the local level. You know, we're going to have to start talking to each other as people instead of woke or MAGA or, you know, left or right. We're all human beings. We all eat. We all have loved ones. We all have a stake in having a survivable future. Reality is reality, regardless of what you think about it. And in reality, we live on a finite planet. Some of us may love fossil fuels, but the reality is that they're finite. They're running out. We've had this fracking revolution over the last 10, 15 years that has enabled the U.S. to produce more oil and gas faster than at any time in our previous U.S. history. Our U.S. oil production grew by, 7 million barrels a day or something like that in 10 years? Nothing like that in previous world history, you know. But that's coming to an end. Even the Wall Street Journal now is saying that the fracking revolution is running on fumes. Post-Carbon Institute, we did a series of reports over the last several years showing that this would just be a short-term, you know, shot in the arm for the oil and gas industry. It's really the last hurrah, because it's, you know, the industry has always gone after the easiest to get, highest quality resources first. And when we're talking about shale gas and tight oil, these are not the best, easiest, cheapest to get resources. These are the bottom of the barrel. And yeah, they have been a shot in the arm for the industry over the last 10 years, but over the next few years, we're going to see declining production in all of these resource plays, the Bakken, the Eagle Ford, even the Permian in Texas is starting to top out. And when that happens, then global oil production is going to start declining for purely geological reasons, regardless of what we do about climate change. And then, you know, well, whose fault is that? Well, I'm sure that some people will say we're just not investing enough, and, oh, it's because the government has put all these restrictions on drilling and so on. But, you know, the reality is we're just running out.
You and I see energy descent as fundamental to any effort to save ourselves. The Secretary General of the United Nations surely agrees. Instead, Joe Biden just authorized a huge drilling project by ConocoPhillips in the farthest north Arctic of Alaska. And these fossil fuels will not come online until 2029 or 2030, the years when every major agency and institution says we need to be slashing fossil fuels, not adding more. The UK government just approved more gas fracking. Everybody's plunging into a dead planet future. How do you see all this?
Frankly, I think it's inevitable. As long as we maintain this misguided view that we have to grow the economy and that the future has to look like the last few decades, you know, everybody has to have a car. We've got to be constantly buying more consumer products in order to grow the economy so everybody has a job. You know, this is an economic system that traces back to the 1930s. When we had a depression caused by overproduction, and everybody got together, industrialists and government politicians, they all got together and said, well, we've got to fix this. How do we do it? Well, we've got to encourage consumption. And consumerism was born with advertising and consumer credit to encourage people to go into debt so they could afford to buy stuff that they otherwise couldn't. And so we've had this growth machine in operation ever since. And now it's just baked into everybody's worldview, whether you're an economist or a politician or just somebody who runs a grocery store. The assumption is the economy's continually got to grow. And the only way it does is with more energy. And where do we get our energy currently? From fossil fuels. So as long as we maintain this mindset, there's going to be the demand for more fossil fuels. So it's not just, as I was saying earlier, it's not just a matter of building more panels and turbines. We've got to change that fundamental mindset, this dependency on growth that we've baked into our institutions. That's the only thing that's going to get us off of fossil fuels.
What happened to the degrowth movement?
Well, it's actually alive and well in Europe, not so much in the U.S. It never got off the ground in the U.S., and it's easy to understand why, because it's the U.S. is where the whole economic growth mania started. It's the country where it's most institutionally baked into how we do business and how we do government. So, you know, it's really hard to get Americans to question growth, but you know, you go elsewhere in the world and people, there are a lot of people who get it, and they're reorganizing their lives to use less and to depend less on money even. You know, I mean, we assume that money makes the world go round. Of course, well, it's really energy that makes the world go round. But, you know, as we depend more and more on money, we use more resources, we alienate ourselves more and more from the natural world and so on. There are a lot of people who get it.
Yep. Just for listener information, there's a degrowth workshop. Well, there was one 26 February in Melbourne, Australia, but there's another conference, Beyond Growth 2023, May 15th in the European Parliament in Brussels. And then the 9th International Degrowth Conference will take place in late August in Zagreb, Croatia. So it's still going. It's too bad that we don't hear more about it, as you say, in the United States or Canada. So, Richard, maybe the current stock and banking system will crash into a major depression. People would make do with less because they have to. Could that help us?
Well, you know, I hate to be the person who says, yes, it could help, because, of course, that makes it sound like I'm rooting for lots of people to lose everything they have and go from getting by to suffering. I don't want anybody to have to suffer. But the reality is we have an economic system that's designed to fail. Given the finite nature of global resources, global energy, and given the necessity for further growth that's baked into the financial institutions themselves, we're on a collision course. There could be an upside to that if we foresee it, if we plan for it, if we start to remake those institutions now ahead of the crisis, then we could build a world, a post-growth world, where we depend less on, as I was saying earlier, depend less on money and depend more on each other and on the health of global ecosystems. So is that happening? Again, it is happening in some places. And if you go to, you know, somewhere like Costa Rica, you're going to see a very different reality from what you see, you know, New York or Los Angeles. And it's in the places, I think, where we refuse to acknowledge limits that we're going to see the most suffering. And again, I don't want to see anyone have to suffer because of all of this, but I'm afraid we're setting ourselves up for it.
Do you think rationing is a way to make this smaller pie more fairly distributed?
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up, because I definitely think that rationing is in our future, and rationing could be a great way to get ourselves through this bottleneck. What is rationing? Well, it's a way of apportioning scarce resources so that everybody has what they need, and that's exactly what we need. We've had rationing during both world wars. In Britain, they had rationing for many years after the end of the Second World War, because they were still recovering and still experiencing scarcity. And here's the thing. During rationing in Britain, as they were rationing food, for example, people were actually better nourished with rationing than they were prior to or after rationing. Again, everybody had what they needed. And currently, everybody doesn't have what they need. We have extreme economic inequality and growing economic inequality. And if we try to maintain that, you know, that level of freedom for those with too much to get even more, then those who are at the bottom of the economic pile are just going to, you know, fall off altogether, and the human toll could be just horrific. The way to overcome that is with rationing, and rationing builds social cohesion. If it's fair, that's the key. It has to be fair and it has to be transparent. But if it is, people can get on board and understand this is for the good of everyone, and seeing that they're getting their basic needs met, they'll go along.
Two-part question. Do you still have chickens? And has a flame of post-carbon survived in communities in California?
Yeah, we still do have chickens. We're down to two right now. Unfortunately, a couple of our chickens passed away last year, but we're hoping to revive our flock this year. And yeah, there are fewer, I think, communities in California that are calling themselves, you know, post-carbon outposts. Back 10, 15 years ago, we had a program along those lines, and then there were the transition towns, which we helped to promote. And I don't see quite as many of those sort of grassroots community-level organizing efforts going on now, which is a shame, because we need it now more than ever. So I don't know what the next organizing model will be to get people working. Hopefully that wasn't just a generational phenomenon where, you know, the baby boomers were more into doing that kind of thing and the next generation is less so, because, you know, that's absolutely what's required. We've got to get together on a community level to build social resilience, to build social trust, because that's what gets us through when times get tough. My wife and I learned that when we had the fires here in Santa Rosa a few years ago. It was our neighbors who came to our aid, and it was with our neighbors that we celebrated the passing of the fires, and we had community cookouts and celebrations, and it was enormously healing. I think that's where we have to put our emphasis.
From the California coast, we've been speaking with one of the original post-carbon visionaries, Richard Heinberg. You can find him at richardheinberg.com. I recommend his newsletter and his books. Richard, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure speaking with you, Alex. Thank you. Take care.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I want to thank all listeners for your tips and emails. Write me anytime, radio@ecoshock.org. This program is listener-supported science journalism. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for wanting to find out and caring about this world.